Hello, my name is Tucker Johnson, and I am your host today as we experience NIMSY Live, where we talk about the latest and greatest in translation, localization, internationalization, globalization, culturalization, and all that fun stuff global companies need to delight their international customers. On this program, we like to invite guests who like to have fun and have some value to add for our audience of globalization professionals. I'm always eager to provide a platform to those with a good story or a good data set. So let us know if there are any topics that you would like to see covered or guests that we should reach out to for future episodes. If you haven't already done so, make sure that you're subscribed to NIMSY Insights. We're coming to you live on LinkedIn, X, Facebook, and probably a few other places. So your platform of choice, just hit that follow button, subscribe button, and you will be one of the first people to know when we schedule new episodes or when NIMSY Insights publishes new localization industry research. Before we get started, a quick plug for our sister company, Multilingual Magazine. If you don't have a subscription to Multilingual Magazine, why don't you? We send out monthly issues, beautiful issues. I don't have a copy on my desk or I'd show you. But what many people don't know is that Multilingual also publishes daily localization industry news, which you can access at multilingual.com. So Toral Kovisun, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, is on the cover issue of the upcoming issue. Check your mailbox. They should be coming out soon. So without further ado, let me get into it here today. Today, we are diving into one of the most crucial topics in the evolving world of technology and business, building globally inclusive AI systems. In our current digital landscape, where AI-powered solutions and large language model-driven products are rapidly becoming the norm, the ability to operationalize, productize, and optimize these strategies for global markets has never been more critical. In today's episode, we're going to be exploring practical, hands-on strategies for streamlining localization workflows, ensure international usability and compliance from day one, and avoid costly rework. We'll also cover how companies can build scalable AI-powered infrastructures that allow them to stay agile, adaptable, and globally ready as they expand. This includes role-based localization governance, international user experience-focused strategies, and even AI audits that reveal potential global readiness gaps across languages, cultures, and marketplaces. Today, my guest is Mohammed Mo. Mo Lee is the founder and CEO of GAS. We pronounce it GAS, G-A-A-S, Globalization as a Service. GAS On Demand. Mo's journey in this field started over 2 decades ago as a translator, which later evolved into a mission to transform how businesses approach global expansion. With a unique perspective shaped by learning English as his 7th language, Mo has become a true visionary in localization and international UX. He leads GAS with thought leadership and innovation, pioneering AI-powered solutions that break down budget barriers and accelerate global launch capabilities. In today's conversation, we're thrilled to have him here to share his insights and best practices for building inclusive, scalable, and future-ready AI systems. Mo, welcome to the show, or whatever we're going to talk about today. I have a feeling you're one of those guys that there are many things that we can talk about today, and you'll be able to speak to many of them. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tucker. I will just remember back to the last time we connected first, and I think it was maybe 4, 5, perhaps 6 years ago. I recall you were having a baby, or you just had one, and you were also on the cusp of launching NIMSY. Was that correct?
Yeah, that's about right. You notice a little bit more gray in my beard since then.
Yeah. Well, that sprinkle is blessing, so take it as it comes.
Well, welcome. Tell me, it's been a while. So tell our audience, what do you do? What is GAS? What is this framework that we're going to be talking about today? Give us a quick introduction here.
Certainly. So GAS is globalization as a service, as you mentioned, on demand. And a close look to the logo, actually, I want to speak to, because it's particularly special to my heart, is the notion that we have included sign language into the logo design itself. And that is a nod to an industry or a sister industry that is often overlooked in the digital product development process. So GAS On Demand essentially is a globalization partner, MSP, technology enabler, strategy consultant to essentially help some of the most forethought or forward-looking enterprises, as well as emerging brands, really get the global launch right the first time. And so that's where I come into play. Essentially, with a team of partners, I should pause here to suggest that there has been a metamorphosis, actually. I first, as you mentioned, started in the industry as a translator. And fast forward a couple of years in, I launched A to Z Lingua International, which is essentially a translation company, purely. Over the years, and I'm kind of giving you like just the background really quick before we dive in. Over the years, I actually got suckered into the internationalization space of the field, where rather than throwing over the fence content that I had translated, I was brought in to essentially help developers, designers, product managers, engineers, architects, others better understand why it was necessary for them to account for these translations way before they landed on their laps, and also help them not punch their files, punch their strings and the like. So that's what led to the journey where we find myself today, where GAS essentially is intent on ensuring that the going global process is not merely translated into translation, because that's really what it comes down to for most who do not necessarily know what it means to go global. And so we'll dive into why I approach it in this way. But I'm going to pause here and figure if there is any question that you want to ask before we move on.
No, yeah, that's great. I mean, it's easy to forget sometimes that globalization, because, you know, when you go to school and you study localization, because they actually have courses now where you can study localization. Back when I was younger, they didn't have a lot of localization programs, but it's like the conventional terminology is there's a difference between globalization, internationalization, localization, translation, culturalization, and you learn all of these definitions for these different things. But what I find in practice is we screw it up. And we talk about localization 9 times out of 10 when someone's talking about localization, what they're really talking about is translation. Right?
Precisely.
We use those terms interchangeably. And the same thing can happen with globalization. We get those terms screwed up too.
That's the misnomer that actually gets the whole endeavor to fail in the first place, actually, before it even gets started. It's dead on arrival. I'm glad you mentioned this, because I recall one of my very, very first, I think it was round 3 consultancy gig on this space. It was at FedEx. Mm-hmm. And I arrive on the premise and I'm told, here's a translation team. That's the one that you'll be working with. And right then and there, I'm put off, because that's not what I came here to do. Translation is the last thing that I had on my mind. So I actually borrowed a page from marketing when I realized that. And right then and there, my first order of business was to rename the team. So it was renamed actually the Guilt Team.
Right. I think that's great. And I think more teams on the client side need to think about that rebrand. I think it's a really easy rebrand to make. So rather than call the localization team, or God forbid, the translation team, right? Do not call yourself the translation team. Rebrand into Guilt, or if not Guilt, at least globalization, because I feel that kind of carries everything underneath it, right? Because it accurately reflects all of the stuff that we do.
It literally, I mean, I have a few slides. I don't know if we're in a share screen format. I have a few things that we can visualize and kind of share, but essentially, and if we can
email those to me and I'll bring them up on screen.
Okay, perfect. So what I have here is, just picture your layered, multi-layered onion, right? Mm-hmm. You have a translation as the outer, you know, yellowish orangish layer, and the sub layers, you have these localization, which is essentially where the UX design and the content design decisions are taking place. And I explained to folks that the internationalization, which is a sub layer underneath that, is essentially where, I'm hoping that I'm speaking to, maybe we should have actually flagged that to figure what is the makeup of our audience. Is it more client side or is it more practitioner? Because I don't want to basically reiterate things that maybe already know by
it's
my
everybody.
People.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So the other part of it being internationalization, sub layer underneath localization, which is essentially the software enablement aspect of it, where I'm thinking encoding, I'm thinking, architectural decision, I'm thinking a number of just structural concept that basically lay out the foundation of the app or the product or the web app. And then globalization, which is essentially that decision that happened on the business and product management side of it, which is where I like to begin. Because at the end of the day, product management drives everything. And if you're able to make yourself not part of, as a localization player, not part of marketing, not part of engineering, but rather part of product management. So let's call you a globalization product manager. Boom, you have what it takes now to get yourself in rooms, in discussions, where there are epics being decided upon, there are features being given capacity, and other discussions vis-a-vis what are we going to do on the next PI and the PI after and the PI following. And all of a sudden now you can actually weave localization requirements into the features that are at on the table, essentially. And that's where whether you're writing up PRDs or MRDs or and again, I'm speaking to an audience that I'm unaware of. So PRD, product requirement documentation, MRDs, marketing requirement documentation, etc. And essentially from there, what I have is an opportunity to devise specific requirements that actually account for international usability. And they're built into definition of done. As in when the designer is done with their mockups, when the UX researcher is done with their deliverables, when the developer is done with their code work, what will happen is that they'll be endowed, and that's basically where I come up with the GILT framework. They'll be endowed with a checklist of items that they need to account for as they do the work, so that they can check off definition of done, as in we've completed the work as per specification, as per requirement. Unless you have that built in, you're not going to end up with what you intend, because again, translation, as the saying goes, things get lost in translation. And if that's what your understanding of the endeavor is, then you've actually misstepped from the start.
Yeah. So let's agree with everything you got so far. Let's take a look at the framework. You said you had some slides for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me see if I can actually shoot you this. I'm going to just reply to the email exchange.
I think what a lot of folks on the client side, I mean, and they agree with this. They want to take on more and have that seat at the table, implementing localization friendly, internationalization friendly, heck, globalization friendly things upstream. But I think one of the challenges that many people have, many localization leaders have, is just getting that seat at the table. Right. So, I mean, maybe that's something that we can talk a little bit about, getting that seat at the table. How do you get the VP of marketing to sit down with you? How do you get the VP of product to sit down with you? Because if you can't even start those conversations, then you're dead in the water already.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love it. So how you get them to sit down, how you get them to actually take interest is you hit them with the data. They're measured by specific criteria, by specific KPIs, and by specific OKRs that actually literally I can link all things localization to that say to, case in point again, I'm not gonna name the client, but this client was actually churning through, and this is how we got a seat at the table. They were churning through 25% of their budget. I kid you not, that's $750K annually tied up into rework.
Rework, literally, as so far as like rework. Poor quality as translations as, or?
No, not poor quality translations. As far as you've done the work of essentially doing translations and you've loaded your system and you find that, oh my God, we have these instances of internationalization malpractices built in. So tech debt that is in the form of hard-coded strings, that is in the form of bad maybe strings resourcing or missing strings altogether. Just basically the structure isn't there. The ABCs of launching globally haven't been checked off. And so what that meant was they had to literally for every single defect, and I think there's one of my friends, I would say, Adam Asnes, actually from Lingoport, would speak to till the end of the day on this topic. But that is essentially the notion that they failed to account for internationalization requirements, and now they found themselves having to rework to address technical debt that resulted from their own bad decisions.
So that's what I had. Bad decisions, but to be charitable, it's kind of one of those things. It's like you don't know what you don't know, right? And this is why people like you and me have jobs, right? Because you know, if you're a product guy, if you're a developer, like it's not your job. You know, they don't learn all of the intricacies of internationalization, localization. You know, a lot of these developers, you know, they take, you know, internationalization is just one semester if they're lucky, or it's like one chapter of a larger textbook in a development class.
And you've been generous actually with that chapter.
Yeah, exactly. And internationalization, you know, respect to the internationalization guys out there, like Adam, because it's complex. It's because everyone's code is different. Everyone's product is different. So there's no, like, it's very hard to put together, like, these are the steps to internationalize your code, because you can't write that book because it's not going to be relevant to everybody.
You can't write that book, but and that's part of why I'm actually an insider author in a way, because part of my role actually entails writing these guidelines, writing this book for various teams. And so I was talking to you, and because we're talking, I haven't actually gotten around to actually emailing this, but I'm going to speak to it. The guild framework, you know, how do you get a seat to at the table was your question.
Great.
How you get a seat at the table is essentially tying the losses, the churn, the operational expense baked into launching globally in a fashion that resonates with the organization that we're bleeding dry. And the analogy that I always use is the following. We're doctors, and we run these MRIs, we run these x-rays, and we show the patient that, listen, it seems like you're doing good. It seems like you're actually doing that which you intend, which is rolling out global product. Mm-hmm. But it's costing you more than it should. You're expensing more than you needed to. And so all of a sudden now you can recapture that overspend, which is, again, amounting to $750K for a particular client. And once you do that, you're now able to gain a seat at the table, because they understand all of a sudden that if we are able to preempt these issues, we will save the company money. And by the way, we'll save ourselves tons of headaches, because new releases won't translate necessarily, all pun intended, into a load of defects that are going to be happening overnight because we put out a new product and now, or a new feature, and now customers are complaining that it's not behaving to expectation, or regionally, worst case scenario, it's not compliant to local standards and laws. And that's where essentially you can actually gain a seat at the table to make this matter. And last thing I want to say on this, and maybe we can peel off that layer too, but I make localization a matter of law. I make localization a matter of compliance. From an accessibility standpoint, it's easy because localization is part of, or accessibility is part of localization. One may claim the opposite is true. And from a compliance standpoint, if you are not, if you're a government contractor, there are laws, and there's this executive presidential order. I forgot the code for it specifically, but that actually mandates of you to provide language access equitable for all. And so if you're not doing that, you're actually landing in court. So at the end of the day, I make it a matter of law. Last example, for driver distraction laws, what happens is you are presenting to the user in an in-vehicle scenario, for example, you present to the user a piece of content that warrants for them to click on the screen, on the HMI, three times or more than they would normally if had they understood the issue. Now all of a sudden I can take these matters that seemingly are mere translation objects and say to legal, hey, I think we're vulnerable here. We have an exposure here. And all of a sudden I get the backing that's necessary to raise these items, because oftentimes you're competing for capacity and now you don't have to because it's legal.
Right. And well, what you're talking about is speaking the language of the stakeholders, right?
Indeed.
And I say this every other episode, like, no one cares about your LQA scores.
No,
they don't. If you're going to your marketing manager or your internal stakeholders and talking about your LQA scores, their eyes are going to glaze over. Now, if you talk to them about the international user experience, if you talk to them about compliance and risk, if you talk to them about, you know, local regulatory missteps, now you have their attention, because you're talking about things that are interesting to them.
Absolutely. My favorite KPI of bragging point is, we translated X millions of words last week. Who cares?
Yeah, who cares?
That's exactly the
how many users did you reach? What was the click-through rate? What was the conversion rate, right? How many more products did you sell? How did you increase your return on investment, right? Those are what people care about. So when you talk about you bring the data to the conversation, that's kind of what we need to talk about, right? Yeah, and so Geo's in chat here says, interesting, Brazilian law demands sign language and subtitles on specific services like movie theaters, political ads, educational materials. Lots of locales, lots of regions do this. You know, in the U.S. we have
Japan.
The U.S. for a lot of services, right? So for government-provided services, like you're saying, you got Executive Order 13166, I think.
Thank you.
And if you're providing services as a government agency or government-funded agency, I believe, you're required to provide language access to them.
100%. Yep.
Right?
Yep. And so now all of a sudden, it's not a matter of you coming to beg for capacity for people to do the translation or localization work that's necessary. It's like, listen, if you don't do it, you translate into fees and fines and, you know, perhaps bad looks. And worst of all, horrible user experience. And that means you have usage down, and what are they going after? Back to that marketing guy that you asked earlier. They want usage to go up. They want revenue to go up. They want traffic to go up. Well, guess what? I can drive all of that if we just maximize the international usability of our platform.
Yeah. Well, and talk to me about, let's use the specific use case or the specific scenario of international user experience, right?
Yeah.
Talk to me about that, because we do a lot of work at NIMSI for localization buyers dealing with international user experience, because I find that that's one of the things. If we stop talking about localization quality, because who cares about quality? No one cares about quality. They only care about quality when it's not there, right?
Yep.
So it's not a winning proposition to go to the table and start talking about quality. But if you go to the table and start talking about, here's the effect that localization is having on the international user's experience, that's a different conversation. And a lot of these big companies, you know, the Fortune 500s, they have user experience departments. They have teams dedicated to monitoring user experience, improving user experience. Yep. They have researchers. They have all of these things already. However, they're very focused on the domestic market.
Thank you.
Localization is an afterthought, as it is with everything else. And I can use, I'm not going to name any names, but some, you know, big companies that NIMSI's worked with is getting the localization team to partner with those guys, right? And, you know, it doesn't take long before the internal UX researchers are like, oh, this is valuable. Like, these guys can help us. So the localization team, that's how they get that seat at the table.
Yeah. Yeah, helping us avoid that expense that we shouldn't have to incur. And if we were incurring it unknowingly, to just bring light to it, opens a whole new world, opens people's ears. So from a user experience standpoint, you mentioned that they have, you know, fully staffed UX teams and research teams. To your point, what happens is, in fact, that is so US skewed or English skewed that even your research deliverables tend to actually voice the needs and the demand and the asks of the US, you know, English speaking marketplace, rather than the Japanese or the Korean or the other locales that are less explicit, that are less vocal. They have a barrier to pass, that is the English, you know, barrier that you erected by conducting all your user research in English to start with. So,
well, and you're missing the cultural component of it too, right? Like, one of my favorite things, and I'll try to do this without naming any names, but a client was working on localized versions of an app, and the app was an exercise app, right? So you could log into the exercise app, track your workouts, and they had this, you know, feature where you could compete with your friends. So you add your friends on the app, and it's like, oh, I ran 3 miles today. Oh, I ran 5 miles today, right? So it's this competition. Now, when they go into a country like Japan, that's much more communal and less competitive, right? Yep. They don't want to compete with their friends. They want to work together. So we have to change the app so that instead of saying who's getting more, it's, hey, let's work together to get 100 miles.
100. Yep. Right? And similar to that, that's why Yahoo had their interface much busier, much more complex in Asian markets than they would in a US market where we're trying to keep more simplistic because we want ABC. We don't want clutter.
Chinese websites hurt my eyes.
Yep. Mental model.
Yeah, our CEO is over in China right now, and he's developing this workshop, and we designed these certificates of completion, and he sent it for me to see. And I said, you need to add like 19 more colors. It's too simple.
What's 19 more when you have 120?
Yeah. But that just goes to show it's like the different expectations of what's normal. Exactly. Right? And I think a lot of times, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier, is that a lot of times we're talking about localization, we're using that word, but we're not doing localization. Very few companies are actually doing localization. They're doing translation.
Yep.
Maybe, like if they have a website, you know, they'll have different buyer personas. Maybe they'll go take the extra step of like changing out the pictures from a bunch of white dudes to a bunch of Asian people.
Right? People with veils, others, culturalization.
Right? But that's like, I don't even see that often, to be honest.
Yeah, there are a few actually that are, and those are my better practitioners, if you will. Even the Fab 7 of this day and age doesn't excel to that degree. I mean, there's much to be learned from an operational, you know, excellence standpoint, because they do this, you know, at a minimal cost. Yet there's still opportunity to actually cut cost even further and maximize and optimize that international usability experience on delivery.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just gonna say, and that's why it's not being done, is because it's complex and it's expensive to do.
Yeah.
You know, you can slap a bunch of, you know, you can slap some content into a TMS, have it translated in 12 language. It's a very scalable process. Once you start truly localizing things, the scalability becomes much less. However, this could segue us into talking about AI and stuff, because now we're seeing this revolution. I would call it a disruption in the way that content is created. And I think a lot of our conversations in our industry, the localization industry, are around how can AI help localization? I think which is an interesting conversation, but I think another interesting, potentially more interesting conversation is how will AI change how content is created? So it's not just changing localization process, it's changing the input, right? So why not use AI in the local markets, right? Because when we're talking about truly specific for different markets, we're talking about having that content generated by and for the local markets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that?
Yeah, real time. Actually, there's a case the point that I was making literally on a similar call about a year and a half ago, to say with the advent of AI, especially ChatGPT at the time, my expectation is you and I cannot land on the same page when we visit the single same website anymore, because Tucker Carlson has this set of preferences, and there is this profile of fees that states to the website, these are the things that I'm looking for traditionally when I go to your website, and therefore you will be fed with a face that is specific to Tucker Carlson. When I go, I will see completely different face specifically on my own individual, not even as an authenticated person, but literally as a public persona, because the information is out there now.
Right.
And so AI taps into your public preference, your travel habits, your anything that you may have put out there to inform its decision as to what color even should I lay out, you know, and display the interface to Tucker Carlson when he visits. That's the future of AI.
The precedent's already there, and it's called, you know, customized like social media feeds, customized advertising, right?
Yep.
It's tracking your stuff. I'm very careful about what I click on, because it's like, if I click on this, I'm going to be seeing ads for it. If I, you know, I click on a couch, then I'm going to be seeing ads for couches for the next 6 months.
And you're doomed even after you buy it.
I know. That's what irritates me. I just bought a table and I'm just like, okay, I don't need a table anymore. Amazon,
No,
you can stop.
you need to buy this one. You need to buy
Yeah,
this one and the other one
I
and
don't
that
need
other
five tables.
one.
But you're absolutely right. And that's kind of an interesting conversation to have about the true meaning of localization. We use it to talk about translation. It should be used to talk about translation and adapting for local markets. But hyperlocalization can go beyond markets and
Absolutely.
go really, it can go to the individual. It can go
Something
to
gets
the individual level.
absolutely, absolutely. To optimal, ultimate personalization. And I often say localization is the ultimate form of personalization. Blend that with AI, you've taken it next level. The thing that I also want to mention, especially that you said this, is to your question about how AI helps the process. And to your second question about the content generation aspect of it, I'm looking at what are the implications for our industry. I
Yeah,
mean,
everyone's looking at it.
a year ago, out of the blue, and I'm sure you've never gotten this from a provider, from a vendor. A vendor calls me to say, "We're giving you 40% off."
Yep.
Out of the blue. Well, because you know the writing, you've seen the writings on the walls. That is why you're making this extension. And quite frankly, I think it's a self-defeating process.
Yeah, I think it's a race to the bottom, right? I don't think I wouldn't advise a client to take that approach and say,
It's a
oh,
self-defeating process.
yeah, it's out of fear. It's a fear reaction, right?
Absolutely. It's a fear. It was completely fear. So we took it. And long story short, we took it. But at the end of the day, here's what actually follows. My point being for the industry, what the implications are. Translation is no longer what we do, Tucker. Translation is a byproduct of the technology, the counsel, the consult, the strategy, and all the other stuff that we provide to those who seek to navigate the global landscape successfully, at scale and efficiently. That's what we actually are charging for now, and no longer notion of just charging for translating. It's so bad that we've gotten to actually price it on a per million words basis now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think pricing in the translation industry is a whole different conversation. I think the industry is in need of an update to the way that we price localization and translation services. I don't think we're ready for it, right? And I think it's, you mentioned Adam Asnes. I think it's him that said this to me. He's like, it's the best worst solution that we have at the moment. I mean, it's the best bad solution that we have at the moment. Like all the solutions are bad, but this is the best one, is the per word pricing, right? But if we're still talking about words in 10 years, I'm gonna be surprised if we're still talking about words in 10 years.
I think you're generous with that 10-year roadway or runway. I'm giving us probably 2025 will sunset upon a new shift, a new foundation for the industry, wherein we're not talking prices anymore. It's just that I'm not selling you a car to say, here's another $25 or $100 extra that you need to pay me because it comes with wheels. It's not a conversation we have.
But the question is, because it all goes back to, well, first of all, let's look at the role of the language provider, the LSP, right? Do LSPs provide translation? Yes. But is that their core competency? Is that their value add? No. If that was their core competency, if all they did was provide translation, they wouldn't be needed. Because buyers could just go directly to the translators. What LSPs provide is supply chain management. They provide project management. They provide consulting and strategy and help with education and expertise, right? So I think when you see LSPs, hitting that panic button and saying, we're going to reduce price of all of our translation, it's the wrong thing because they're forgetting what they're selling. They're forgetting how they add value to the value chain. They add value through vendor management, project management, education, account management, risk management, right? There's, frankly, I think this is kind of one of those unspoken things. A lot of buyers use LSPs for the supply chain management because they don't want the risk of employing people in 100 different countries. because they can't do it right. And frankly, a lot of the LSPs don't do it right either.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's a big roster to manage. I mean, once you hit the 9,000, people that are actually, you know, your systems, your databases, your, you know, your contacts and their prior commitments before you even can get them to take on your project, all in the timing of it. That's why some companies have their in-house translators, which is also another thing. But long story short, the and this is where I guess I'll kind of shift gears to the notion of H2 augmented by leverage of AI, because I remember carrying around as a translator, you know, this, I don't know, 3-pound dictionary with all my digital dictionaries, you know, traveling across the country and kind of having to carry that load with me at all times. And had I had, you know, AI in my pocket, I probably wouldn't have. And now I can just let it essentially do the work for me. And rather than starting with a blank canvas, and I'm speaking really like with envy to the current generation of translators or the newcomers of translations, because I mean, had I had this, I would have lived like an awesome, like fun time where it's less work for maximized return. And so that's the thing where now you can actually concentrate on, is this the right tone? Not just even for the country or for the locale, but is this the right tone for this sub product of this particular brand that I'm working with? Oh, is my audience more of the, I don't know, an affluent, perhaps more trendy segment, or is it you know, Gen X, or is it rather Gen Z? These are the kind of, you know, sub values that you now can add, and even that is at risk of, you know, being actually falling under the AI process, to where now you're just orchestrating a whole, you have a whole market, you have a whole continent, and you're merely orchestrating AI agents that are actually driving the not just translation but the linguistic check. And then you have an agent that also does the validation in market, that does the, oh, is it brand specific, style guides, glossaries? Who cares about that anymore? Because at the end of the day, I can tap into an entire website. I can tap into all of the content that this company has put out there to match its tone. There's no need for all that stuff. And that's why I'm saying a lot of what we do is on the brink of just, you know, disappearing. And people don't realize it yet.
Well, I would say I agree. And let me rephrase that, though. It's on the brink of disappearing versus it's on the brink of evolving. Right?
Because
I don't want to be an alarmist. Oh, you know, everything's dying and I need to go get a job at McDonald's now. It's evolving. It's becoming simultaneously more simple as well as more complex, right? Depending upon your outlook. And I want to bring up Gio's comments here. She says, I just think about how complex it has become to create a website. We need to add a description of each image. We need to add a video. Audio description becomes necessary. It's getting more complex. And really, why is it getting more complex? Because it can, right? Because a base website nowadays is so easy. I could create a website. Give me an hour and I'll have a website published, right?
It's easy to
create a website. So in order to differentiate, companies are creating more complex websites, right? So as the technology improves, the access to complexity, to manage complexity becomes greater, right?
Yeah.
So what that means is, as service providers, whether you're an LSP, a company service provider, or you're a translator, you're a service provider, our offerings need to change to mix that. And we can sit here and say, oh, well, I miss the good old days when I could just translate a website. Well, websites don't exist anymore the way they used to. Websites are a completely different animal. It comes with multimedia. Mm-hmm. It comes with alt text. It comes with metadata. It comes with SEO keyword research. Right?
Yeah.
All of that different type of stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, when you say this, my first thought was essentially you have this user generated content now that existing translation processes clients, firms cannot keep up with. Well, and so
five, 10 years ago, that wasn't an option. to translate user-generated content. I mean, there were discussions. Precisely. There were some companies doing it with machine translation, but it was an outlier. It wasn't the norm. And nowadays, like 5 years from now, if you're not translating your user-generated content, you're behind.
Yeah, you are. Right? You are. I mean, there's nothing worse.
I can go on Airbnb and book a hotel or book a place to stay in Tahiti, French Polynesia. Do I speak French?
No.
But not at all. Un petit peu, right? But I'm talking to the host. I'm chatting in English. She's chatting in French. It's getting translated back to me. And then when the host actually shows up, I can't talk to her because she doesn't speak English and I don't speak French.
Yep.
Right? That's all user-generated content. And that's powered by technology.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And people forget that we actually started doing AI long before AI was a thing. We started doing AI during the statistical age of AI. We started doing AI when it was just a pure matching game. Oh, okay, this word was translated as X before, and therefore I'm going to check the database. Okay, X match, boom, push it out. That's basically the and until we got to the neuro-linguistic or neural powered system. But at the end of the day, that's where
That was AI pre-NMT. That was AI.
That was AI. And unfortunately, and that's where I find that we are in this interesting duality, because funny thing is, if we just pause and introspect, we have been, again, doing AI for so long, and now we're in this predicament where we're not only helping organizations build AI that is universally inclusive, that is multilingual, that is fully localizable out of the box, but we're also tasked with building the AI tools that will power the AI translations that need to actually take place in and of themselves. And so on this point, you mentioned earlier the when you were talking about user-generated, if we weren't able to keep up with user-generated content, what tells you we're going to be able to keep up with AI-generated content? Because that too needs translating. That too needs culturalizing. That too needs adapting such that it can be consumed by different regions in different marketplaces.
Yeah.
I mean, if you, one of the part of key component of my audits that I run is where I actually first exercise, I look at your traffic. Where is your traffic coming from? What is your usage? And people look at, you know, and that's, this also answers your first question, that is, how do you get a seat at the table? You look at the report and it's like, oh, 80% of our traffic, US English, 13% Canada, and the rest split across the globe. And you look at the rest of the globe as, and it's very counterintuitive. You look at it as, we don't have much demand there, therefore let's, you know, invest in these features to feed the beast. But at the end of the day, you don't have demand there because you don't have accessibility there.
Right.
You are not reachable, you're not consumable, and therefore your demand is very low, your usage is very low as a result. And that's the kind of flip of the script that I gave when people are reluctant to see the opportunity rather than the gap.
Right. And a lot of, I mean, you're talking about providing the data that we started this conversation with, right?
Yeah.
A lot of localization directors don't even know that data, right? And, you know, when I'm talking with someone on the client side, I'll ask them frequently, I was like, what percentage of your revenue comes from international markets as a company? Mm-hmm. They don't know.
Yeah.
They don't know because they're so in the weeds of, you know, it's like I say, they know their LQA scores.
Yep.
Right. But they don't know what percentage of their revenue, their company's revenue. Because if you have that, now you're talking about data that's actually meaningful to people outside the localization department.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can drive the agenda. You can negotiate capacity. You can
either secure. Way. If 80% of your revenue comes from foreign markets, then you can say, look, 80% of our revenue comes from foreign markets. We need to prioritize this. If 20% of your revenue comes from foreign markets, you can say only 20% is coming from foreign markets. There's untapped potential here.
Precisely.
Right? So it's a no lose for you as far as being able to drive the agenda.
Precisely. I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah. But I mean, it starts with getting that seat with the table, getting that seat at the table, talking about things. And, you know, there's some really great, you know, if Yeah, there's some great case studies out there of localization directors that have come in and been able to kind of change the agenda, change the way that people think, right? And those are the companies that are able to do, the Airbnb example I was using earlier. That's because the localization director over there, Salvo, he talks directly to the CEO, right? He's
And
gotten
that's what
that
you
seat
think.
at the table, right? So it takes that's what it takes in order to make
That's
a
what you
huge difference is
think.
getting the ear of the right people, but earning it.
I not only earning it, but also making, like, sometimes if that door isn't open, you gotta open it yourself. And I had CEO ask me once, between our user, so the false choice he presented was, and that's what I basically, that was my response. The false choice was he presented was, do we localize first for our customers and users, or do we localize for the actual institutions, the companies that are our customers? So there's the end users, and in between, so think of it as a B2B to C. And so my reply was very simple. At the end of the day, you're looking at this as a cost, barrier, and it is only a cost barrier because of the model we are currently operating by. But by the time we were done with that, in that whole discussion, he realized that this was a false choice. You are, yes, true, you have to feed the end user, but at the end of the day, you're also selling to the customer. And if your marketing material, your email communication, your status page, your event page, your website, everything is actually, and the platform is in English, and you're just translating this endpoint interface level content, then you're actually missing. And again, people do this. I have this pyramid of Maslow inspired hierarchy pyramid of content needs for translation. And long story short, all of that at the bottom that's not catered to is because of cost. The cost barrier is why people have their website maybe translated into two languages when they know that, well, in America, well, there are more than, 64 languages that people speak on a daily basis. And at the end of the day, you want to make sure to cater to those because otherwise they can't access your platform. So false choice, again, as I mentioned, and it came to that. And the necessary investments were made by literally showcasing to this CEO that indeed there was not just gaps from your perspective, but there was also an opportunity. And you also bring in the markets. That's another thing that that's lacking in the process often, where you're not getting a seat at the table, where the voice of the international customer is not making it to the product decision room. And so what do? You bring in a voice, a speaker, or you do a market survey
Oh, that's
to.
why consultants are great, right? And I'm biased because I'm a consultant. NIMSY's a team of you're a consultant, right? So yeah, we're kind of preaching to the choir here, but it's sad, but it's true. A
It
lot
is.
of times consultants are hired because the internal experts aren't taken seriously. I can't tell
Sadly.
you how many times I have to go in and tell a senior management team, the C-suite, exactly what the localization director has been telling them for the last 5 years. And I put it in a nice shiny report, give it to them, and they say, oh, this is great. They send me a check and they make all of the changes.
And that's basically the benefit of the on because and I understand why that's happening, because again, I've been on
I
both
get
client
it.
side, and that's kind of the life that I live, where I have one foot on the client side, one foot on the vendor side. But the reason for that is you're not, so when I, the analogy that I use is, I'm telling you this because it's important for the company, it's good for the company. I'm not trying to build my empire.
Right.
You see what I mean? So there's a
It's that
bias
third
there.
party unbiased opinion. I get it, right? I get it. I mean, is it silly and inefficient? Yeah, but especially when you get to like the bigger size companies, you have to have safeguards in place to make sure that people aren't just trying to build their empires.
That's what it is, unfortunately.
Yeah. So I'm watching the clock here. I'll start wrapping this up here, but as a closing exercise, let's say I hire you. I work for a Fortune 500 company. I'm a localization director. I say, Mo, I want you to come in and advise me. It's like, I can't get the budget approval I need. They're asking me to do more with less, right? They're not listening to me. We're getting complaints from international markets, just all of these challenges, right? What are the top three things? What are the first three things that you tell me to do in order to change my situation?
Well, first thing I want to get you to actually take this from a product discussion, from a, oh, we need to, your mandate, your task is what? let's translate the platform. Let's make sure that the product is accessible internationally. But I'm actually being undercut on budget. I'm being maybe de-resourced in a way. And so higher demand, lower capacity, right? I flip the coin and I say, at the end of the day, this is not a matter of just translating the platform, as I said earlier. It is a matter of how well, how good are we at going global? And you measure that across different layers. At the functional level, there are certainly KPIs, there are metrics that I can set in place. But at the organizational level, it's like you tell me you're Boeing and your job is to build these airplanes, and they're reliable, and they're, again, maybe the wrong time for that right now, but long story short, your job is to build these fleets of airplanes. Well, if you're doing that so well that you can build 1,000 a month or 2,000 a month because you have such excellence built into your operations that it's so well oiled that you don't have to pause to ask, okay, what next? Or you don't have to wait for some deliverable that is a dependency externally or internally to come in so you can build upon that and continue your process. So I say, let's take a step back. What is currently the organizational capability for doing that which you're intending to do? And that actually is basically where I start with the scorecard. We do a full audit from start to finish of, what is your experience on a mobile, on web, or anything that's relevant, whether it's in vehicle or in cockpit, anything that is necessary. And then I present to you the fact, from an international usability standpoint, these are your ratings. It's like your accounting report. And those type of numbers speak very, very, very deeply, because they'll tell you precisely without any, sugarcoating, and with not just data to back, but also voice of the customer statements, lots of market feedback that specifically states, well, this is why I'm not using the product right now, because X and Y and Z. And that now gives the product decision team the ammunition they need and the baggage they need to actually revisit their roadmap in the way it is currently prioritized and figure out at which point do we inject this notion that is internationalization? At which point do we inject this notion that is accessibility? And there are several other domains. And that's actually where, from my standpoint, I don't just look at it as this global endeavor thing. And there's observability, there's maintainability, there is operability. There's so many, there's 18 dimensions, domains that we actually build into this audit that give you a full picture of how well you perform. If your load time is in this region is 10 times as much as it is in the US, then come on, I'm not gonna sit there waiting for your system to load. I have alternatives, I have options. And that's why that conversation actually can be essentially better actually enhanced by even building into markets whose jobs, VPs of sales, VPs of support, foot level or road level foot soldiers who actually are involved directly with the customers to get their feedback and to basically bring home how hard is it for us to sell in X, Y, or Z market? How hard is it for us to renew a deal that we already have, and why is it that people are leaving us? You put this on the table, I mean, there's no debating. The question is, okay, what do you need? And 9 times out of 10, I'll get, okay, what do you need? What is it going to take for us to get from this point where we are, that is really dire, I didn't realize, to that point where we now can operate, at efficiency, roll out across all markets that we desire, and not look at cost as a barrier for these projects that have been sitting around for so many years now. So that's how I would go about it on day one.
Yeah, it's simple.
Yeah, it's simple, but then it's not.
I'm joking, right? Because, yeah, it's a simple concept, but it's a complex process.
Yeah, it is. And it's also not, and that's also another thing that's beautiful about this, because the model doesn't say, here's what the consultant has said. The model, the report doesn't say, here's what, Mo has said or Tucker has said. The model says, here's the report, and here's a look in the mirror. And that's telling. You can't debate that. It's a look in the mirror. It's a scorecard that tells you specifically how you're performing against each and every single international dimension, from revenue to usage, all the way back to usability.
Yep.
And you tie the two together. It's like, okay, usage, if you want revenue, well, then follow, enable usage, because that's the key right there. And now we're speaking the same language.
Yep. Well, Very good. I think that's a great place to end. We're watching the clock here, running out of time. Any closing thoughts, though, before I shut her down for the day, Will?
Well, I'll say this. I'm gonna send you. I don't know how you're gonna convey that. I really was anticipating, and maybe next time I'll have a dry run. But long story short, I was expecting to run people through visuals that are more telling than my 1,000 words. And I'll just send these to you, and you'll figure how to convey it to people.
Schedule another live stream. Let's do it again. What the heck?
All
All
right,
right.
let's do it again. Let's figure out what time might be convenient, and I'm happy to come back any day.
All right. Well, it's good to see you. Good to hear from you. Thank you so much for taking time for us today, Mo.
It is my delight. Thanks, pleasure.
All right. I will take us out here. Ladies, gentlemen, chat. We are out of time for today. If you enjoyed this NIMSY Lab experience, make sure that you are following us on LinkedIn so that you will be informed when we schedule the next one. We've got a couple in the pipeline here coming up in December, so be on the lookout for that. Got some exciting guests coming on. I appreciate our guest today, Mo. I appreciate my colleagues here at NIMSY Insights doing all the hard work. And finally, I appreciate you, the audience, everyone joining us live today in chat. And I look forward to next time. Cheers.